There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1075, December 23rd, 2024. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say in the mood and in the news. We have Checo checks out. Kiwi has landed. Bottas back at Benz. Battle for Algiers begins in Albert Park. And size matters. We shall explain gladly. Back to you, sir, the big kahuna of podcasting.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Sergio Perez has left the Red Bull facilities. Liam Lawson is Red Bull's new sacrificial lamb. LCH has been reminded of Schumacher's return letdown. And happy holidays to all the F1 Weekly listeners. And this week's interview, French TV commentator Julien Fabreau. And you'll understand because this guy is gifted. And yes, I must remind everybody that we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab right there on the front page. You know, you want to. Nas, happy holidays. I know you're working overtime for La Familia. So I hope you're doing well. What's really going on in F1 today?
Well, Gato is out of the bag. Checo is out of Red Bull. I don't think anyone is surprised apart from his papito. In my very humble opinion, Checo's fate was sealed when he signed the contract to be Max's teammate. We have seen this movie before, and I think sequel is coming soon. Sergio did his best, took 5 wins with Red Bull. Interestingly, all came on street circuits. He joined Red Bull in 2021. He was never in their junior program, but had established a well-deserved reputation as a solid driver, if not the next Speedy Gonzalez. The environment he was in was such that his own world championship winning teammate would not help him to secure second in the standings. This is called ruthlessness to the max. This is what Christian Horner said to Craig Slater of Sky F1.
What do you think happened to him, Dan? Has he explained to you where he lost his way and how? Does he have a proper grip on it?
I think that's the thing. I think that he's not really quite sure. Of course, the car was it became more narrow in its performance window, and he struggled with that compared to Max. But obviously such an enormous gulf in points difference between the two drivers. He was struggling with that, and that of course then puts more pressure on him, and the harder you try sometimes, the slower you go. And it became almost like a vicious circle for him. So there were flashes of old form in Azerbaijan, but unfortunately that didn't translate into points. So it's been a hugely frustrating campaign for him. And of course that's hurt us quite badly in the Constructors' Championship.
Regarding his plans for 2025, Checo has already stated he is not interested in IndyCar racing. I just don't see him in WEC or NASCAR. He may take a season-long siesta and then regroup with a mid-pack team. A lot will depend on the continued support of Carlos Slim, El Jefe at Telmex. I think he and Bottas will make a good team at Cadillac. Both are good team players, race winners, and to borrow a phrase from Christian Horner, engage their brains before they engage their mouths. Senor Rogers, where would you like to see Sergio Perez in 2025 and beyond?
Well, certainly Cadillac is definitely a big option. It's very well known in Mexico. He's very big in Mexico. He brings a lot of visitors to the United States for the Grand Prix. I think he still has some attraction to him. He's a good driver in a good car that suits him. Yes, I think Cadillac would be nice, but we'll see. I mean, he could retire. His father is probably not calling Carlos for more billions, but I'm not sure. I don't know. It could be Checo's Mexican bar in downtown Monaco. So who knows? But I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun because I have a funny feeling he's got a lot of cash. And you know what they say, cash is king.
Next on the agenda, the Kiwi has landed. According to Liam Lawson, he has been dreaming of Formula One since he was 8 years old. In 2025, he will have the immense pleasure of being teammate to Max Verstappen. I have been following Liam's career for a few years now, back when he was racing in his own native country. He is a very fast driver, very dedicated, and a lot more professional in his approach than the other driver from WeCarb who was not selected to go to the mothership. The most impressive thing about Liam is that apart from Formula One, almost every series he has raced in, he won on his debut weekend. Formula 3, Formula 2, DTM, Japanese Super Formula. These are very competitive series. All this is very good and positive, but I have to say, I pity the fool and the smarty pants who signed the contract to be teammate to Max. And we wish everybody all the best. Liam may be catch of the day for Red Bull, but IBM presents, you make the call. Will we see Liam Lawson race in a Red Bull at Yas Marina in 2025? What say you, amigo?
Well, Liam obviously thinks that his testicles are going to match up to Max's. He is confident in that. He is and will be capable to keep up with Max. He's not looking at Checo, Gasly, Albon, Kvyat. He's not looking at any of these people, which is good. I think Liam, if he can just finish second behind Max, he will be extremely successful. We'll get a lot of money, and that's the most you could possibly ask for. Now, you never know. Max might get sick, get pissed off, quit the series altogether. We'll never know right now, but for 2025, it's going to be competitive, and Liam is now in the thick of it, and I think he can handle it. I really liked his bitching about McLaren playing the British National Anthem. It was good, and that is a very valid point. So it's going to be cool. He's going to bitch more. I hope he gets used to bitching, and we have one hell of a race, especially if Aston Martin is competitive. Wouldn't that be cool? Come on, Fernando.
On the other hand, there is a lot of sympathy for Yuki. He will now enter his fifth year at the Red Bull B team and will have fifth teammate in as many years. According to Yuki, he destroyed them all. He may have a point here, but there is no denying he is quick. But I think he destroyed his reputation by his demeanor in junior Formula. His favorite and most frequent message on team radio in his Formula 3 days was, "Shut up." Not much change in Formula 2, where again his speed was impressive. Racing against Mick Schumacher, who went on to win the F2 championship, he was able to get race win and pole position. In 2 years in Formula 2, Mick was never quick enough for a pole position. Very surprising. In 87 Grand Prix starts, his best finish is fourth in the 2021 Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. That race should have been sponsored by Burger King. Have it your way, Mr. Race Director. Yuki's explosive behavior has been on full global display since they arrived in Formula 1 in 2021. I say if he wants to be JPM, and we're not talking JP Morgan Bank here, of Japan, then more power to him. He was asked what he needs to do to get the Red Bull seat, and he had a typical Yuki response. Maybe pole position and podium in every race. He is like Mount Fujiyama, ready to explode any time. Liam Lawson is from New Zealand. They have a lot of sheep, and they are orderly. I think Red Bull made the right decision. If Yuki was taken and able to rattle the cage of Max, if that is even humanly possible, Honda would have taken him to Aston Martin with him. So, Senor, do you like Liam's promotion or do you have a beef or mutton with Dr. Marco's decision?
Thank you, Nasser. I love mutton. Keep up the good work. Well, see, I was thinking of the humorous, more interesting side. And not only that, but the get it over with and done with. Yuki, this is Honda's last season with Red Bull. And it would have been nice to see Yuki slaughtered by Max in living color. But it doesn't matter. I'll watch anybody get slaughtered by Max. It's part of the gladiator mentality we have today. But no, I feel bad for Yuki. You know, he feels like he's machismo and he should have been promoted. And you never know. I hate to think that Yuki could have been the one to compete against Mac, but we'll never know. So that's a big question in my mind.
Now we move on to Bottas back at Benz. Valtteri is all peaches and herb, reunited and feels so good. Toto Wolff was one of the money men behind Bottas in his junior career. As his manager, he brought him into Mercedes Formula One team to have the immense pleasure of being teammate to Lewis Hamilton. During COVID, LCH fell sick and George Russell replaced him for one race in Bahrain. His performance in the race sealed the fate of Bottas. At Sauber, he was on the Albert Hammond program, underloved and underfed, and he wanted to go home. Home is again Mercedes-Benz as reserve driver and possible backup in case Kimi Antonelli keeps doing what he did at Monza in free practice. Now we come to something that I am really looking forward to. Battle for Algiers. With the signing of Isaac Hadjar, the grid for 2025 is now complete. The spirit of Guy Moll is back. Moll was a driver from Algeria of French heritage. He won the Monaco Grand Prix before being killed at a young age during a race in Italy. Hadjar is a French driver of Algerian descent, very quick in speed and temper. He and Sonoda will provide 2 hours of comedy every race weekend. The RB team will be Scuderia Screamers. This year, Hadjar was a close second in the Formula 2 championship in his second season to Gabriel Bortoleto, who won the title as a rookie. Hadjar's other racing achievements include third in the 2020 French Formula 4 and fourth in the 2022 F3. He and Yuki as teammates will be a lot of fun. I will miss Franz Tost. Both Lawson and Hadjar dreamed the impossible dream. Now their wish has come true, and we wish both of them all the best. We will enjoy their success and report on it gladly. But they have to be careful. The Red Bull window of opportunity is fully automated. It is not Anderson window which will keep the heat out. It starts opening after your first three races. The slower you are, the faster it will open, and you may be sucked out of your seat before the season is over. It's called the De Vries effect. Once upon a time, Mika Hakkinen outqualified Ayrton Senna the first time they were teammates. More shockingly, Eddie Irvine outqualified Michael Schumacher when they raced together for the first time. Can you imagine the celebration and jubilation in New Zealand if Lawson was to outqualify Max at the opening round, which will be taking place not too far from NZ or NZ? What's your opinion, sir? Can Liam do to Max what Danny Rick did to Seb? And will Isaac shaft Yuki?
I guess we all know the answer, but I'm keeping it on an open mind here. You never know. Max could have a bad year. He might have a hangnail at the beginning of the season. We just don't know. His wife, his significant other is pregnant with their first child. So Max is going to be under a whole new set of pressures. So you never know. This is the time. If you're going to be Max's teammate, this is a perfect time, because now with a child on the way, he may change internally into this paternal instinct situation. So it's going to be fascinating. Liam can do it, but it'll have to take a lot of digging and a lot of praying. But it's going to be interesting. And you're right. Tsunoda and Isaac Hadjar is going to be fantastic. Culture shocks, culture wars. There'll be screaming, hollering. I can't wait when they tell Tsunoda that your teammate is faster than you. So we've got a fun season. I mean, it's going to be great. Last year for the DRS. So I think the DRS trains are going to be worse than ever, because everybody's going to be so tight and competitive. Exciting.
Damn right. Now we move on to age is just a number. Two BFFs are on the front row when it comes to answering, are you experienced? Once upon a time, they were teammates for a season. On pole is Senor Alonso at age 43, racing at the top level for over two decades and over 400 Grand Prix races. Still going strong, simply incredible. Sharing the front row with him at age 39, 40 next month, is Lewis Hamilton. 356 Grand Prix starts in 18 seasons. More wins and more pole positions than any other driver in Formula One history. And 7 world titles. Once again, simply incredible. At the bottom of the age grid, we have LCH replacement, the Italian Kimi. He likes to talk and is also very quick. 18-year-old when he rolls into Albert Park in March. Then we have two 20-year-old newbies from Formula 2, Bortoleto at Sauber and Hadjar at VCARB. Mr. Rogers, the old guns may run out of ammunition pretty soon. Among the young Turks, Bortoleto, Hadjar, Antonelli, Behrmann, and Doohan, who do you see as the next Pasha of performance?
Well, on this, I have to go with Fernando and Más Macho del Mundo. Fernando said that Bortoleto is an extremely talented driver, and if Fernando says that, I believe it. It's going to be fun. Unfortunately, Bortoleto will not have a competitive package. So Antonelli is at Mercedes. They looked good till the end in 2024. They need to start looking fantastic for George and Antonelli in 2025. But once again, we have McLaren that's going to be stirring the pot. We hope Aston Martin will be stirring the pot. Look how competitive Gasly and the Alpine was at the end of 2024. Definitely adding some intrigue. Haas, for goodness sakes, was fantastic in their climbing up the ladder. So, my goodness. The only thing that's going to get in all the way of this is, oh yes, Williams. Now they have Sainz Jr. And Sainz Jr. is definitely hurt. His feelings were hurt. And now he has to prove that everybody blew it, skipping Sainz for the top teams. And he has to make a big point in 2025, or his testicles will be removed. So it's going to be an interesting season. And I'm hoping that Williams, with just a little bit of work, they have a good motor. I mean, it's the same motor that McLaren won the Constructors' Championship in 2024. So Williams just needs a few tweaks and aero, and boom, they could be right there in the top five, especially with a motivated machismo. So, yes, too much excitement, but Bortoleto is the one to watch, according to Fernando El Mas Macho.
Now we come to five famous firsts. Last week we did seven deadly wins. This week in Historical Mondial, we present five famous first wins, which we all enjoyed very much.
Round, turn three we go, and it's Nico Rosberg, and Hamilton's onto the grass, and Hamilton's had a massive crash, and he's crashed into his teammate. The two Mercedes come together.
We shall start with the youngest ever winner in Formula One history. This was the opening of the door to the days of wine and roses and many, many wins for a teenager in love with anything moving fast on four wheels. A day in history and a record that will never be broken. Today he is a four-time world champion, and we are talking about the 2016 Viva España in Barcelona. This was the season of total uber domination by the Silver Arrows. We all make mistakes, and both drivers took each other out on the opening lap, and that would be Mr. Nico Rosberg and Sir Lewis Hamilton. Red Bull numero uno at the time, the smiling assassin, should have won this race, but the team shocked the monkey and Danny with the timing of his pit stop. This opened the door for 18-year-old Max Verstappen to grab the lead, which he would not surrender, despite coming under intense pressure with the help of DRS in the closing laps from Kimi Raikkonen. So, very impressive maiden win. Next.
In his 113th Grand Prix start, he's proved the critics wrong. They said he might never win a Grand Prix. He's done it! Jenson Button wins the Hungarian Grand Prix! Get in there!
JB and the winning goulash in the Hungarian Grand Prix, 2006. Arnaich had to wait over 100 races before he would get win number one at Brands Hatch in 1985. I remember watching this race and what a day it was. Mansell and media never got along. Well, so this was quite an achievement for a chap who was an electrical engineer and was fully charged on and off the track. His compadre from Frome in Somerset, UK, by the name of Jenson Button, aka JB, also went over a century of races before he got his maiden win in that wonderful changing conditions in the Magyar Republic. I will never forget his big eyes with his helmet on after he got out of the car. There was another hombre who could have won this race, but he crashed out in slippery condition. Who could that be? But I think the wheel was not properly fit after the pit stop, if I remember correctly. Just like Mansell, Button got his opportunity with the best car, and he grabbed the bull and the Red Bull by the horn and took the title in 2009. While Rubens Barrichello was wondering, where was the brake pedal halfway through the season? Now we go to Monte Carlo.
Trulli comes out of Anthony Noakes. He's going to see the man with the checkered flag. And Jarno Trulli is going to win his first ever Formula One Grand Prix. There is the checkered flag.
Trains ran on time under Mussolini. They were slow and long under Trulli. For once in his lifetime, he had the tunnel vision and beat his teammate at Mile 7 Renault to win the 2004 Monaco Grand Prix. According to Chief Engineer Pat Simmons, Trulli's teammate was like a cat on a hot tin roof after the race. He felt his cage had been rattled, sign of things to come. As would turn out, the Monaco Grand Prix victory in 2004 was the first and final for Jarno. And by the way, Jarno Trulli is named after a very famous Finnish motorcycle racer, Jarno Saarinen, who was killed in a crash at Monza in 1973. Next we have...
In 2012, we had four from four. It's now going to be five out of five. Another different winner. A new winner in Formula One. It's Pastor Maldonado.
Over the years, Formula One has seen fire and rain. But the Latin fire, seen on May 13, 2012, around the hills of Barcelona, will live in infamy. Man on a mission all the way from Maracaibo in Venezuela was none other than everyone's favorite, Crashado, also known as Pastor Maldonado. LCH was stripped of his pole position, so numero uno on the grid for the race was Maldonado. But the local muy macho hombre took the lead at the start, which did not surprise anyone. But what surprised everybody was to find Señor Maldonado in the lead after the pit stop sequence. And even more shocking and surprising was he did not crash. In fact, he beat Machismo on home soil and Kimi the Iceman was third. That photo of Kimi and Alonso holding up Maldonado on the podium is one of my all-time favorites. Absolutely beautiful image and one for the ages. And I may see Pastor if he's racing at Daytona 24 Hour next month. And folks, finally we come to the Monaco Grand Prix of 1972. And this one even has the right background music.
Jean-Pierre Beltoise blasts out of the second row right at the start to take the lead, leaving a rooster tail of water as a slap in the windshield to the other 24 entrants. Veteran race drivers dispute the adage that oil and water don't mix, and the figure skating of many cars on the wet, oily Monaco circuit would bear them out. France's Jean-Pierre Beltoise has piloted his Marlboro BRM to victory.
Shining on a rainy day was Monsieur Jean-Pierre Beltoise. The former meat delivery driver from Paris delivered the last Grand Prix for BRM in taking his maiden F1 victory in Monaco. Only other driver on the same lap was Jackie Ickx, second in his Ferrari. Dr. Helmut Marko was eighth. Beltoise passed away a few years ago and was married to the sister of François Sever.
And Nas, on that note, why don't we take a quick break? And we'll be back with Motorsports Mondial, which really consists of a couple of interviews. Of course, we have Julien Fabreau, which is a fantastic conversation. And our bonus is Jager Jones. That's right. Jager Jones related to Parnelli Jones. You're going to like it, ladies and gentlemen. So we'll be back after these brief messages.
Hi, I'm Joseph Newgarden, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
La ligne droite est plus courte que la première. Il est un peu loin. DRS ouvert, l'accélération vers Ascari, ce ne sera pas avant Ascari, ça ne peut qu'être après la chicane d'Ascari, il faut encore tenir. Allez Pierre, il faut tenir jusque dans les derniers instants. Il reste la parabolique tout au bout là-bas, elle est loin, elle est infiniment loin cette parabolique. Écarte-toi, ne le laisse pas t'aspirer. Il se met à l'intérieur, il fait de la récupération d'énergie pour essayer de sortir de la parabolique. Elle est presque là, cette victoire. Accélère, accélère. Oui, il va aller la chercher. Ne lâche pas. La victoire de Pierre Gasly. Il l'a fait. Victoire de Pierre Gasly. Victoire d'AlphaTauri. La victoire française. 24 ans, 3 mois et 18 jours après Olivier Panis. La France, de nouveau victorieuse en Formule 1, il l'a fait, Pierre Gasly, exceptionnel, victoire historique, Pierre Gasly, vainqueur du Grand Prix d'Italie. Ah, il y a de la déception, bien sûr, chez McLaren. Écoutez ces noms. Trintignant, Sever, Beltoise, Lafitte, Depailler, Jabouille, Arnoux, Pironi, Prost, Tambay, allez-y, Panis. Et aujourd'hui, Pierre Gasly, vainqueur d'un Grand Prix de Formule 1. Oui, monsieur, oui, madame.
Okay, folks, Sammy here with Monsieur Julien Favreau. Julien, good to meet you. How are you today?
I'm very good, very excited about the race with coming soon now. So the excitement is growing up minute after minute.
Your homeboy is on row two. Can he win the race?
Everything is possible, especially in Las Vegas. But honestly, it's going to be tough. I'm pretty sure the Mercedes and Ferrari pace will be high, but anything is possible. Pierre is a fighter, and he will give everything. But for sure, he's got in mind the fact that they are playing for the sixth place in the Constructor Championship. That is the most important thing. So maybe not risk everything at the start or during the race, and try to maximize the points will be the target for them today.
Okay. The commentary you did on the last lap of the 2020 Italian Grand Prix is one for the ages. Not many people expected Gasly to win the race, so I'm guessing what you said, especially when you read the names of all those French Grand Prix winners, this was not scripted but came from the heart.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an unbelievable situation, unexpected. As you said, at the beginning of the race, it would have been impossible to imagine Pierre winning the race, but anything is possible in Formula One. And from the moment we understood that maybe he could win, we knew that it would have been tight with Carlos Sainz from behind. But as soon as I felt that Pierre was able to win and was about to win, I ask myself, what can I say if the victory is coming? And my target was to name all the French winners, because it was an unprecedented moment. And with this new French victory, it was the perfect timing to celebrate all the French winners. So my target was to name there in the right order, and to finish my list with the name of Pierre Gasly. So he was joining a very tight club, and it was important, before introducing Pierre in the club, naming all the guys, all the members of the club.
And you counted the years and months and weeks. That was incredible. Now, names like Sever, Beltoise, Depailler, Jabouille, Pironi and Tambay, they have all passed away since I started following Formula 1 in 73. Did you know some of these drivers personally or professionally?
I must say, not really. The last person I met was Jean-Pierre Jabouille, but I can't say we were close or we knew each other very well. We met sometime, and it was always a great moment. The last time I met Jean-Pierre was in French Grand Prix in Le Castellet, and for sure it was emotional, because it's such a legend. He achieved such great things for Renault, for the French French motorsport world. And but no, I'm too young, but I know them, and I know what they achieved, and it was unbelievable at that time. They took such big risk driving those cars in the 70s, in the 80s, and my admiration for them is no limit.
Well, speaking of Jabouille, we all know what happened at Dijon-Prenois 1979. Question is, if that race has taken place, do you think both these drivers would have been like banned for life?
I mean, what Jean-Pierre did in Dijon is unbelievable. It was the first victory for Renault, and the shame is everybody remember what happened behind him.
Yeah.
And when you ask people about Dijon, people say, "Oh, Pironi Villeneuve." And when you ask them, 90% are unable to say who is the winner. And maybe some will say Pironi or Villeneuve. No, there was a guy in front, and it was Jabouille. So, yeah, he made history in his own way.
Yeah. Okay, now the very first Grand Prix took place in France in 1906. What are the chances of the race coming back on the calendar, and which track would you like to see as the home of French Grand Prix?
For sure we need a French Grand Prix. We deserve a French Grand Prix. I mean, France and motorsport, France and automotive are so linked that it's unbelievable that we don't have a Grand Prix right now. But we all know that there is so many topics and so many things involved to have a Grand Prix. So for sure, I desperate want to see a French Grand Prix back in the calendar. I hope it will happen soon or later. I hope soon. I don't know. There is a great track in France. Manicourt was a fantastic place for sure, but Le Castellet is also an interesting one. And I don't want to say I don't care the track, but I mean, first I want a French Grand Prix wherever it is.
Now the link you are talking about will sadly be broken when Alpine goes Mercedes engine. How has this gone down with French racing media and fans?
You mean the situation with Alpine?
I mean, Mercedes engine.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it's sad for Viry Châtillon's people at the engine factory because they are so talented and they deserve maybe something different. But it's a tough environment. Performance is the number one topic and the number one reason for Alpine and Renault Group to be involved in Formula One, and they take very pragmatic decisions. So they study the situation, they compared for sure different numbers, and at the end they took this decision. So I hope they took the right decision and they will have some success in the future. But for sure, French engine is something big. They created most of the part of the most incredible engine in history. And yeah, let's see what could happen in the future.
Okay, Alain Prost remains the first and only French world champion so far. Do you think Isaac Hadjar would be the next French world champion?
Isaac is such a talented driver. I don't know, because even when you are a great, great driver, you need to get all the planet in line to maybe hope of something good. And for sure, he's got the talent. Helmut Marko and Red Bull trust him very much. Maybe it will be in Formula One next year. I hope so. Finger crossed. It's impossible to answer the question. But regarding his personality, his character, his talent, his skills, I think he's got everything to be world champion. But you need many, many other things. So only the future can say the truth.
I understand you arranged a flight in a Rafale fighter jet for Charles Leclerc.
Yeah.
How did that go, and is he now convinced something can be more exciting than a Ferrari Formula One car?
I don't know if it's more exciting. It's a different kind of excitement, but for sure I was so pleased to organize and to create that documentary with Charles. This is a documentary that I think about for maybe 10 or 15 years. I always wanted to organize something with a fighter jet and a Formula One. And when I had a dinner with Charles in Australia after the Grand Prix on Sunday, and when I asked him, "Would you like to jump into a fighter jet like the Rafale?" And I say, "What? Is there any possibility for real?" I say, "Let me check, but maybe we can do something." And finally, after that, he was so convinced, so he wanted it so much that it was finally pretty easy to organize, even if we had a lot of stuff to put together. But yeah, we enjoyed 48 hours together, and he had two unbelievable flights. The first flight was 3 hours 22 minutes, which is a very long flight, and the day after almost 3 hours. So he spent a lot of time in the Rafale, and he was able to pilot and to have the command, and he had great fun. I know it will remain a great memory for him, for me also, for everybody involved in the project.
Okay, in the years you have been covering Formula One, I'm sure you have interviewed a lot of drivers. Who were easy to deal with and who were problem child? As I would like to call them, the buttheads. We need some dirty laundry, please.
Honestly, I have almost had only good memories and only good drivers, a nice driver. I for sure, with French driver, it's always easy because we know them personally for long. And whether it's Romain Grosjean, Pierre Gasly, Esteban Ocon, for sure, Jules Bianchi was such a nice guy, and I will remain very close to his family, and Jules is always in my heart as much as Antoine Hubert. So we have a close history with those boys. I know them since they're kids and in go-kart. So when they arrived in F3, F2 and F1, I already know them pretty well, so we are very linked. But also with Sebastian Vettel. Sebastian Vettel is someone fantastic. Daniel Ricciardo, Max Verstappen. People think that Max is arrogant or not a good guy. He's a really good guy, very polite, very well educated. So I always had good memories with Max also. And there is some few drivers that it was not easy to work with. Ralf Schumacher was not easy to work with. Paul Di Resta was not such a smiley guy, but we never had problems, but there was not a warm relation, but it's okay, no problem.
Between Ocon and Gasly, who's more popular in France?
I don't know. They are close in a way and different in personality, but I think they are very appreciated. You just have to look at the people reaction after Brazilian Grand Prix. In France, everybody was very happy for both of them, so people were going to prefer Pierre, others were going to prefer Esteban. I don't know. I think we have to let this small battle or fight between them away. They are two great racing drivers. We have to pay them a lot of respect each other.
Okay, I appreciate your time. Finally, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? What part of France are you from? And what was your first motor race as a fan? And what do you remember most from that day?
I'm coming from west part of France, Brittany. I was born in Rennes, and I grew up in Brittany. After that, I came to Paris to have my journalism school. But my father was a rallycross driver, so for sure my first memories about motor racing is a rallycross, following my dad, washing and cleaning his race car as a very little kid. And I thought it was something very important in the performance of my dad. So this is my first memories. And regarding Formula One, I started to watch Formula One on TV when Michael Schumacher arrived, so early 90s. And it was such a phenomenon. Michael was described as a new generation of drivers. What he achieved was tremendous, and I start watching Formula One when Michael arrived, and I was shocked, and a big fan of Michael, and my target was always to start to work in Formula One as a journalist before Michael retired. So I succeed because I started in 2025, and he was in Ferrari for two more years, 25, 26, 05, 06, and I felt very lucky to be journalist in Formula One and to be able to get interview with Michael.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Merci beaucoup. Grand plaisir.
Okay, folks, we're here in beautiful Barber Motorsports Park with young, talented young American, Mr. Jagger Jones. Jagger, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you?
I'm very good, very good. We're here at Barber right now, and we're about ready to go for our race today. So just getting amped up, ready to go.
Your first name gives me the impression that your dad, PJ, is a fan of Rolling Stones. Is that correct?
No, so it's funny because a lot of people think that, but my parents really said I wasn't named after Mick Jagger, more just Jones being a more common last name than wanting to stick with a J name. We have a lot of J names in our family, and make something interesting too.
Sure. Okay, now we both have the same favorite restaurant. Question is, do you prefer double double with sauteed onions or regular onions at In-N-Out?
Yes, In-N-Out is my favorite. Being an Arizona boy, that's kind of after high school football games or pretty much anywhere, In-N-Out's the go-to place. I don't eat cheese, but I do go for the double meat and extra sautéed onions.
Very good. You're studying in NC, North Carolina. Do they have In-N-Out there?
No, we don't. All we got is Cookout and Bojangles and places I usually try to stay away from. So when I get to go back home to Arizona, it's a good treat to have In-N-Out.
Exactly. I miss them too here in Florida. I mean, I live in Tampa, you know. Okay. I followed your dad's career when he was driving for Dan Gurney. And your grandpa, Parnelli, is a great Indy legend. Who has been a bigger influence in your racing life?
I think for me, I've always kind of looked up to my grandpa a lot, just because he was kind of the person that started the Jones family legacy in motorsports. And obviously, what I really respect about my grandpa is how successful he was, not only in IndyCar, what he's most known for in the Indy 500, but he won 11 NASCAR races, Baja 1000s, Trans Am, and he was a guy that could get in any race car and go fast and win and be the guy to beat. So I really respect that about him, and I've done a lot of different types of racing myself, raced some NASCAR stuff, go-kart, some off-road, and now doing the Indy Next Series. So I've always respected that about him, of how he's been able to be. He's such a diverse driver.
Yeah, he's very well respected outside the U.S. also. Okay, your racing goals are Indy 500, Daytona 500, Baja 1000, Dakar, and Le Mans 24-hour races, plus the Daytona. Winning which race will give you the most satisfaction?
I think that's a huge list of races that maybe would be cool to compete in one day, some of those. But my main focus right now is IndyCar and winning the Indy 500.
Okay. How come no love for Formula One, which we love so much in the palatial studios of F1 Weekly?
When I was younger, I had dreams. I raced in karting. I went over in Europe and raced in some karting stuff, and F1 was always a thought. But as an American, it's pretty tricky to make that happen. I think you have to move over to Europe very young. And after I did some race there in Europe, I came back and kind of started doing some NASCAR stuff. So I think kind of F1 for the most part was out of the question. I think you kind of have to be on a very step-by-step path from a young age, and that's not really what I did when I was younger. So I think I love watching F1. I think F1's super cool, but I think IndyCar kind of might suit me a little bit better, and my family's got more history here, and I kind of like how IndyCar seems a little bit more driver-based rather than the manufacturer and team-based like you see in F1 a lot. But I respect F1. I think it's definitely the pinnacle of motorsports in the world, and it's super cool.
Okay, speaking of European racing scene, what kart racing tracks did you race there, and what were your best moments there?
So I did a few one-off races, and then I did the Academy Trophy Series, the series where it's kind of an arrive-a-drive, and they select a couple of drivers from each country. And I think Stingray was selected, who races IndyCar now, but I don't think he was able to go that I can remember. But I raced at Zuera in Spain. I did pretty well, and then got crashed in the final. I think my best finish was fourth or fifth over there, and then I think I finished 10th in the Rock Cup finals when I was a little bit younger. I only did about eight or nine races over there, but did a lot of karting stuff in the U.S., won the Pro Tour National Championship here. Yeah, we did a lot of karting, but didn't really ever move over to Europe and really focus on that goal.
Your SCUSA Championship, I believe, was in 2014. What was the main difference that you saw or experienced between go-karting in the U.S. and the depth of talent compared to what you experienced in Europe?
I think, obviously, in Europe, I think you just have, it's kind of the hot spot. So you have these people from all these different countries, from Australia, obviously kids all over Europe at the time, Russia, the United States, like the best couple guys from each place were migrating and going and racing karting in Europe. So it really made Europe, the depth of competition there in karting was really insane. And I went over there and I was fast right away, but it was a different driving style. Like over here, we have a lot more blocking and defending rules, and it seems like people are more willing to kind of work together. And you go over there and it's all out chaos. I remember the first race that I ever did there, people were swerving across the track, and I was like, my eyes were open. It was a whole different deal. So I got used to that over, and I think it definitely made me a better race car driver.
Okay. Now, after karting, you raced in California and NASCAR Series, finishing second in the NASCAR Menard Series West in 2019. What made you go oval racing and not into something like U.S. Formula 4 or Junior Series road racing?
I've always loved NASCAR as a kid and respected the oval racing. And I came over, I was doing some karting stuff, and I was kind of looking to transition into cars, and we kind of wanted to try some stuff. I did some Skip Barber, drove a Skip Barber car, and then I went and tested a Legend car, and I really liked that. So I started doing some Legend races while I was still karting and was winning like all the races there and doing really well. So I kind of made a decision. I thought there was a big future in NASCAR, which I still think there is. But I really liked the oval racing. It was super competitive. And when I needed to make the decision of what I wanted to move into in cars, I knew someone who had a late model team that had a really good team for me to be and go race in California near where I live in Arizona. And it just seemed like the right move for me. And at the time, I was really set on NASCAR.
What came more naturally to you, oval racing or road racing?
I would say probably road racing, just because from the age of about 9 years old, I started racing go-karts on road courses. So I kind of grew up focusing on road courses. And then when I went to the oval racing stuff, it was a little bit of a transition. I think especially when you're a kid, you race on all these road courses where there's a lot of grass and runoff, and then now you're having to run a stock car with 500, 600 horsepower inches from the wall, and it takes commitment, and you're racing side by side, and those people aren't afraid to use the bumper or their doors to pass you. So I think that I had to learn in that aggression a little bit, but I think ultimately it didn't make me more of an aggressive race car driver.
Last year here in Alabama, you won in U.S. Pro 2000 Series. How important was that victory, and can you do the same this year in Indy Lights?
Yeah, it was super cool to get my first, it was only my second Formula car race ever, and to come out and win here last year at Barber Motorsports Karts was super cool. I think this year we're starting 13th, so it's a little bit of a different show and definitely a more stacked field of competition. So I think the plan for today is to just try to stay clean and kind of capitalize on people's mistakes and try to make our way up in the top 10 and maybe more near the top 5 today.
There are several drivers who are in their second, third year in the championship. As a rookie, what kind of a result will make you happy, and who will be your main challenges for Rookie of the Year honor?
So I think today, with a little further starting position and it being a pretty tricky passing track, goals to kind of work our way into the top 10 today. I think throughout this year, it's just the main goal is to learn and to eventually be up in contention fighting for wins and poles by the later half of the season. And with a new team, Kate Motorsports, we're progressing quickly, but it's still a learning experience for us, getting the cars right, getting my driving right. So that's the main goal, is to kind of keep learning. It's only my second year in open wheel racing, transitioning from the stock car stuff, so pretty much all these guys have four, five, 6 years at least, maybe like you said, 2 to 3 years in Indy next. So it's definitely an experience thing a little bit, but I'm not here to make excuses for myself. It's just if they can do it, then I can do it. I've been fast and won in anything I've raced before, so it might just take a little bit more time at this level, but I'm pretty confident it's going to happen.
Next question, very important. Your grandpa won the 1963 Indy 500, and last year you were on the podium in the road course races at Indy. Did that give you special chills and a sense of family pride?
Yeah, I think it was super cool. Indianapolis Motor Speedway has obviously got a huge place in our family, and it was cool to get on the podium this last year and almost win. So maybe this year go back and try to get a good result. And I'm really looking forward to running on the oval, though, and the Indy 500 eventually.
Okay. Last question. Do you have a favorite driver in Formula One?
In Formula One, I would say, I know he's not necessarily the fan favorite, but I really respect Max Verstappen. I've been following him since he was in karting when I was going over there racing in Europe, and just his mentality, so serious and dedicated to racing, and I think he puts a lot of effort into it, and he's a natural race car driver, and he's kind of like an old school racer in a way, and I always respected that, and I think he's so talented. He's someone I kind of watch and try to learn some from stuff the most.
Okay, thank you so much, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Now we come to size matters. Long story short, in this segment, we look at the longest and shortest tracks in Formula One these days, and this is as per current configuration. The long and winding road starts with everyone's favorite, located in a forest not far from the German border, in the land of Jackie eggs and potato chips. Spa-Francorchamps. When you talk to drivers who raced in days before Halo and Amco, the favorite is either Spa or the classic Nordschleife Nürburgring. Spa is located in the French-speaking part of Belgium and opened for business in 1921. Originally a street circuit between small towns, it is big in history and important races. The original layout even included an actual bus stop. Mr. Rogers, you were at an important Belgian Grand Prix. Please share your memories of that race and place.
Ah, yes. Spa-Francorchamps. So exciting. I happened to be in Belgium for the 11th International Citroën Car Rally, which was in Rochefort, Belgium. And we were leaving that wonderful program, and we looked at each other and we said, hey, Spa is just down the road, let's go check it out. And sure enough, 1998, Spa, Francorchamps, me, the mud, bus stop chicane, David Coulthard, and Michael Schumacher. What a glorious, glorious rainy day. I saw the beginning, the crash, famous last words from Michael Schumacher, ready to kick some ass on Coulthard. So yes, I was there, and that's the way it was.
Back in 2013 at Spa, we had a memorable F1 Weekly Familia get-together. Garrett was there from New Zealand. Tech Talk Tim was there with his Papito. Adrian was there from UK. Dr. Mark and I were traveling in Mr. Brazier's European support vehicle number 1. Instead of taking ferry on the Mersey, we took ferry across the channel. Motorsports heaven on earth is the only way to describe Spa. The current layout of the track is 4.3 miles long, that is 7 kilometers. The original F1 track for the 1950 Belgian Grand Prix was 8.8 miles. About 14 kilometers, and this race was won by Fangio. The high-speed circuit and changing weather conditions has seen many serious and fatal accidents. 2 British drivers were killed in separate accidents during the 1960 Belgian Grand Prix. It was a serious crash at Spa in 1966 which led Jackie Stewart on his safety crusade. F1 driver Stefan Bellof, the Schumi of Germany before Schumacher, was killed in 1985 in a sports car race. All the great drivers won here many times. Schumacher is the most successful with 6 wins. This includes his first F1 victory in 1992. Senna has 5 wins, including 4 in a row from 1988 to 1991. Hamilton also has 5 wins. 2 world champions have won 4 wins each year. Jim Clark, his first win came at Spa in 1962, and Kimi Raikkonen. He won twice with McLaren and twice with Ferrari. 2 drivers won at Spa in their own cars. Dan Gurney in his Eagle in 1967 and Bruce McLaren in his McLaren in 1968. 2 famous world champions who never had success at Spa are Jackie Stewart and Machismo. The second longest track at 6.2 kilometers is the street circuit in Las Vegas. Last year was the inaugural event promoted by Formula One itself. And apart from the manhole issue before the race, it was well received. And some people enjoyed $1 million packages and $1,200 a night hotel stay. But that's another crowd. Needless to say, the night race was spectacular with all the razzmatazz you expect in Sin City. Liberty Media promised and delivered a much better fan and local resident friendly race in 2024. The third longest track is another new street circuit in the Sands of Arabia, the Jeddah Corniche Circuit, which is 6.17 kilometers long. This is a fast track. Average speeds around the circuit is around 250 kilometers per hour. In fact, the only track faster than the Jeddah street circuit is Monza Autodromo. So that makes it very, very special street circuit. Ross Brawn, then working for Formula One, said of the track, and I quote, "What we want to see is a race circuit. We don't want Mickey Mouse circuits. We don't want those old classic street circuits with 90-degree turns. We want fast sweeping circuits, circuits which are going to challenge the drivers, and they're going to love it," end quote. Just one more point, Mr. Brawn, with all due respect. How about the sound from the old days? Thank you very much. The first Saudi Arabian Grand Prix took place in 2021 and was won by LCH. Next is Baku Street Circuit at 3.7 miles or 6 kilometers. In Liberty Media lingo, oil-rich states have destination cities. So Formula One landed in Baku, Azerbaijan. Of the 6 races here so far, Red Bull has won 4 times. The first race in 2017 was won by Daniel Ricciardo. Checo won in 21 and 23. His teammate Max won in 20, 22. Hamilton won in 2018 and his wingman Bottas won in 2019. Baku is well known for the clash of the Red Bulls, Ricciardo and Max in 2018. And Lance Stroll's first podium in 2017. And what a proud papa Lawrence was on that day. Completing the top 5 of the longest tracks is Silverstone. The birthplace of Formula One today is 3.6 miles long, or about 5.8 kilometers. 3 famous teams took their first championship Grand Prix victory at this track. Alfa Romeo in 1950 with Nino Farina. This was, of course, as we all know, the first ever F1 race. 1951, Fraulein Gonzalez from Argentina gave Enzo Ferrari his first championship Grand Prix victory. In 1979, it was Swiss timing as Clay Regazzoni wins the British Grand Prix, first F1 win for Frank Williams. In 1973, American Peter Revson took his first F1 victory at this track. LCH is the most successful driver at Silverstone with 8 wins. And Johnny Herbert, Pretty Boy Floyd of Motor Racing, took his first F1 victory here in 1995. The shortest track is the street circuit in Monte Carlo, 3.337 kilometers. Grand Prix cars have been racing here for a century now. It is one of only four tracks today which was also on the schedule in the first season of Formula One Championship in 1950. The 1950 Monaco Grand Prix was the first F1 success for Fangio. Jack Brabham took his first F1 win here in 1959, driving a coupe. Tragedy struck in 1967 when Italian driver Lorenzo Bandini crashed his Ferrari late in the race and suffered fatal burn injuries, and I think he died 4 or 5 days after the accident. Graham Hill was known as Mr. Monaco for winning here 5 times. Victory in 1993 gave Senna 6 wins, making him the most successful driver in the streets of Monte Carlo. Monaco has produced 3 one-hit wonders, Jean-Pierre Beltoise in 72, Olivier Panis in 1996, and Jarno Trulli in 2004. The only American success in Monte Carlo came in 1965, when Peter Revson won the Formula 3 race here. Jim Clark never won the Monaco Grand Prix, but winning the Indy 500 on the same weekend as the Monaco Grand Prix, plus the Formula 1 World Championship in 1965, same year of course, makes up for it. The race on the waterfront has seen 2 drivers go into the Monaco harbour, Italian Alberto Ascari in 55 and Australian Paul Hawkins in 1965. Both were rescued. Now we come to Sandford, Max's home track, which is 4.25 kilometer long. The original circuit opened in 1948 and was much longer. The first championship race in 1952 was won by Ascari and a Ferrari. The 1967 race saw Lotus 49 and Ford Cosworth DFV winning on debut with Jim Clark at the wheel. James Hunt and his Hesketh took a famous maiden win over Niki Lauda in 1975. Mario Andretti's victory in 1978 is last win in Formula One for an American driver. Now we come to Checo's hometown, Mexico City, at 4.30 kilometers. The track is located in Magdalena Michuca Park, and first Grand Prix here in 1963 was won by Jim Clark. The 1965 Mexican Grand Prix was a triple play. Maiden win for driver, Richie Ginther. Maiden win for constructor, Honda, and maiden win for tire company, Goodyear. So quite a bit of history here. Now we come to the Brazilian track in Sao Paulo, Carlos Pache Autodromo at 4.309 kilometers. Named after Bernie Ecclestone's Brabham driver who was killed in a plane crash in 1977. He won his home track race at the home track in 1975. The inaugural Brazilian Grand Prix at the same track in 73 was won by another local talent, Senor Emerson Fittipaldi. And this victory in 1975 for Pache was his first and only. Now we come to Austrian track, 4.318 kilometers. The original old-school Österreichring was fast like the pre-chicane Silverstone and Monza. The first championship race at this track was in 1970. Local legend Jochen Rindt was on pole. Jackie X won the race for Ferrari. In 1976, John Watson gave Roger Penske his one and only success in Formula One. And Niki Lauda finally won his home race in 1984, driving for Mr. Ron Dennis. And of course, the Austrian track today is owned and known as Red Bull Ring. Mr. Rogers, before we come to Musical Mondial, would you like to say something to the F1 Weekly Familia or any other thoughts you may have?
Thank you, Nas. I just want to thank everybody for listening all these years. We've been around for 19 years now. And it's unbelievable. It's been a great adventure. I appreciate all the work you do, Nasser. It's fantastic. What a great season we just had. Max winning 4 world championships. It looks like in a blink of an eye. And 2025 is going to be fantastic. It'll be our 20th anniversary, Nasser. So lots to look forward to. And keep up the good work, Nas. Happy holidays.
Okay, folks, to end the show, we come to Musical Mondial. You know, the world of Formula One is very international. So are we in the palatial studios, at least in our own minds. This day and age, there's a kind of hush all over the world to get Africa and Lola Falana in Formula One. Hopefully, sooner or later, this will happen. What will happen now is some beautiful music from Africa. This tune came out in the 1970s. It was a huge international hit, like Oba Gangnam Style from Psy some years ago. We thank you for listening. Please enjoy Mr. Manu Dibangu from Cameroon and some Soul Makossa. Bye-bye.
Good night. Yeah.